This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, Episode 6, was recorded on Wednesday, June 12, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I'll be joined this week by petroleum geologist Art Berman, former market regulator Chris Cook, and commercial broker Pat Hemsworth. Our listeners have asked us to broaden the discussion beyond crude oil to other energy markets. Macro Voices is a listener-driven podcast network, so we're responding to that request with a natural gas focus this week. Our topics this week will include U.S. natural gas production and pricing anomalies, as well as the current market sell-off in crude oil, gas, and everything else in the energy complex. But first, let's dive right into the EIA inventory data. Crude oil building 2.2 million barrels this week. That takes us back to a level not seen since July of 2017. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 2.1 million barrels. Gasoline, building 764,000 barrels. So it's builds, builds, builds across the board, with the singular exception of distillates drawing down 1.0 million barrels. Tape action, there was a quick pop up initially, probably in reaction to the fact that the build on crude oil inventory was big, but not as big as API had predicted the afternoon before, on Tuesday afternoon. As soon as that information was digested, though, we moved modestly down at first, and after the rest of the day sort of chugged on, and it became clear that both RBOB gasoline and the crudes were going to close below their short-term moving averages, well, then the selling really got going, and we saw a sell-off into the close and after the close. In many ways, in my mind, this is reminiscent of 3 weeks ago, when we had a setup where there was a very bearish inventory report. There was some modest to moderate selling, which occurred on Wednesday, but it wasn't until we had seen that daily close below all the short-term moving averages that the selling really got going on Thursday, the day after inventory. So past experiences are not at all a certain predictor of future results, as we all know, but certainly there is a bit of deja vu here. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the rest of this week brings. Will there be a big bounce off of critical support right around $50 to $51, or are we going to see a breakdown to even lower numbers? Time will tell, but we will get our expert panelists' views on where things may be headed later on in today's podcast. U.S. production ticking down to 12.3 million barrels. 12.4 million barrels was an all-time record last week, and 12.3 million barrels was an all-time record just a few weeks ago. So we're still teetering right on the edge of all-time record U.S. production. Imports, 7.6 million barrels per day. Exports, a massive 3.1 million barrels per day. So that's 21 million barrels of crude oil exported from the United States on the week, and even after exporting those 21 million barrels, there's still 2.2 million barrels of additional stock added to inventory this week. So a very bearish report. Now let's meet this week's expert panel. Pat Hemsworth is a commercial broker with Paragon Global Markets, and her decades of experience in both the paper and physical markets give her tremendous insight into the dependencies which exist between markets. Pat, my question to you is about the flooding and crop damage that America's farmers are facing and how that situation is affecting energy markets, particularly diesel demand in PADD 2. So please give us the whole rundown on the entire situation and what we can expect.
Well, I think that this is a beautiful example of how they're integrated. But in this particular case, there has been drastic, dramatic, catastrophic flooding in the agricultural heartland. And what's happened is that we have a delay in the planting of corn and soybean crops. Right now, at this time of year, we'd normally be almost completely planted. 96% of the crop was planted at this time last year, 67% this year. And so what we're seeing is, as a result, a drop-off, a dramatic drop-off in demand in distillate in PADD 2. PADD 2, which is the Midwest. And what we heard yesterday in the WASD report, which is the USDA update, is that the also yields are way down. And it looks as though there may be a component of the farmers that do not plant and receive disaster payments, either PP, prevent planting, or full disaster payments. And if, in fact, they do not plant, this will be like a double whammy where the combines that consume diesel to plant will also not be using diesel to harvest those acres. And it looks as though 3 million acres are lost to production right now. This is because it's the beginning of June where normally we hit a cutoff where it doesn't really make sense to plant. But that depends on the state. So it looks like there were about 3 million acres lost, and also the soybeans, which can be planted later, there's a cutoff soon for that. So we're watching very carefully the demand and the stock levels in PADD 2. And what we saw this week, though, was an actual slight reduction of distillate. So I think there's less distillate being made in PADD 2 now, you know, and kind of adapting and adjusting to the situation in the heartland. So that's one factor that's affecting distillate. In a broader sense, I think distillate is interesting because right now, well, we've spoken on this call about IMO 2020 and how that should increase demand, global demand for distillates by about 1.7 million barrels a day. And so potentially there's a supply crunch coming. And what we're seeing now, however, is, you know, relatively, and we're 4% under the five-year average in the United States overall for distillate. So, you know, my question is the market really kind of underestimating at this time, you know, despite, okay, so on the negative side is the drop-off in demand from the flooding. But on the other side of the equation, what we're seeing is this big potential bump in demand toward the end of the year. And it looks as though, almost as though the market is discounting that, not taking that particularly seriously. What we're seeing now is a kind of a weakening of all the spreads. We're seeing the funds selling distillate. Right now, you know, as you know, we have a fixed index long position in almost all commodities. But now, on a net basis, funds are beginning to build a short position in distillate. So what we're seeing also is we saw a big, big drop in gas oil in London as far as the fund long position. So I think that, you know, maybe there's a big question mark. Are we pricing distillate correctly right now? Are we just focused, you know, very much on the weakening economic conditions? Are we focusing on the building products in Asia? I'm not quite sure, but it's very interesting to me that with stock levels in the United States at 4% below the five-year average, that we are sort of weakish and we're weak on the crack spreads and we're weak on overall price. So, you know, and I also watch distillate versus RBOB, and that's running about 7-cent premium to RBOB right now. So I think it's kind of interesting. There's a interplay of different factors, you know, in the marketplace right now. They say the speculative community is pretty much short, but I'm wondering what the next step to look at is. And, you know, as far as the weather situation, there's mad planting going on right now, but more rain is to come. So this is a very, very dynamic situation to watch in terms of PADD 2. But the broader picture is, hey, what's going on with the overall stock level and IMO 2020?
Okay, thanks for that, Pat. Chris Cook is a former market regulator with decades of experience in energy markets. Chris, most of our listeners think of natural gas as the gaseous form of hydrocarbons produced by oil and gas wells. But it seems that our illustrious politicians in Washington have rebranded natural gas as freedom molecules. Chris, what's going on here, and why is the Trump administration suddenly so interested in putting this new spin on natural gas produced domestically in the United States?
Well, I think this is a part of a bigger strategic picture, this strategic concept of energy dominance announced in July of 2017. And, you know, we're also looking potentially at, you know, other molecules of freedom molecules of shale oil, of course. But here we just focused on gas because the announcement by Mr. Winberg on the 29th, well, was it 9 days ago? He actually was referring to the permissions being given to the Freeport LNG operating. I think it's the fourth train which is being, Art could probably correct me on this, but I think it's the fourth train which is going to be given permission. The point being that, you know, gas is in such surplus that it now makes sense not just to transport it, but to transport it internationally and to give the benefit of US freedom molecules to the rest of the world. Now, there's nothing really new about, you know, freedom molecules because the Soviet Russia actually exported Soviet revolutionary molecules for decades to Germany, you know, and that was when during the Cold War. And Iran exported Sharia molecules of oil, actually, to Israel, interestingly enough, for about 14 years, courtesy of Mark Rich. So essentially, these freedom molecules are pretty free, actually. They don't really have a nationality. So that's quite an interesting phenomenon, these freedom molecules. Now, in my view, what we're seeing here is that the US is able to export shale oil and natural gas and to produce them almost without limit. And I think the funding of these freedom molecules is the most interesting thing. We might come back to it. And also, we're seeing geopolitically some very interesting dynamics. We're seeing, for instance, that we're seeing, you know, the Germans and the Russians are being threatened with sanctions in relation to Nord Stream, this new pipeline being directly connecting Russia to Germany and bypassing the existing pipeline through the Ukraine. And this is being sanctioned because, obviously, we can't have molecules of tyranny coming directly to Germany rather than passing through Ukraine. And this has become so transparently, stupidly, and it is stupid, the US is being laughed at now in Europe because of this, because it's so transparently obvious this is about commercial advantage. Session of, I think that's how you pronounce his name, of Gazprom, he's saying, well, and this was in response to molecules of freedom, he said, well, you know, Russian molecules are actually 30% cheaper than US molecules. And it makes no sense to deliver them to Russia. Unless, of course, you're having your arm twisted by sanctions to take delivery of these things. So on the one hand, what we're seeing is this apparent ideological spin of Russia bad, you know, molecules of tyranny. You know, the whole thing is just becoming a little bit of a joke. It's transparently obvious that we have a president who is into deals and the art of the deal. We have a trade which is, you know, neutral. You know, oil is a neutral and energy is a neutral commodity. Molecules don't have a flag on them. And, you know, Tehran is happily exporting electrons of enlightenment to its neighbors, you know, and this is going to cause a severe problem. You know, we're actually seeing the US negotiating a trade-off in Iraq right now. Basically, the deal is, yes, we will let you, Iraq, import electrons of enlightenment, right, in exchange for Exxon or whoever getting some nice, tasty, big oil field deals.
Thanks for that, Chris. Our final panelist this week is petroleum geologist Art Berman, who spends most of his time drilling oil wells, but he's also become a favored keynote speaker and consultant to investors. Art put together a slide deck for today's show, and you can download it from our homepage at macrovoices.com. My question for you and your slide deck, Art, is why are EIA price forecasts as low as they are, $64 on WTI and $68 on Brent, for the rest of 2019, when both EIA and all of the other agencies are forecasting supply deficits relative to expected demand?
Well, that's a great question, Eric, and one that I've pondered not just with the release of EIA's short-term energy outlook yesterday, but for some time. And the simple answer is they're marking oil price to market is what they're doing. And so if we look at slide number two in my deck, this is the distillation of what's contained in the EIA's recent report. And so this is showing the balance of production and consumption, which is what EIA deals with. And as you can see, the blue means we've got too much, and the red means we don't have enough or we have a deficit. And so right now, Q2 is the biggest red bar down on the right, and we've got a pretty substantial deficit, minus 0.6 million barrels a day, and it decreases about to a balance, and yet price never gets above $67 for Brent. So what the heck's going on? If we look at the next slide, part of the problem is that production is not the same as supply, and consumption's not the same as demand. And if that hurts anybody's head, sorry about that. But the problem is, and this is why I'm so focused on inventory, is, I mean, believe it or not, inventory is not only a big part of supply, but it's a big part of demand. And so production is just one piece of supply, and consumption is just one piece of demand. So for instance, Chris was, you know, just talking about natural gas. Well, we produce a lot of gas in the United States, but we also export a lot of gas. So demand is both our domestic consumption and also the piece of it that we send elsewhere. Bottom line on all this is, if you convert all this from production and consumption to supply and demand, the 600,000 barrel a day world deficit shrinks to 200,000 barrels a day in the graph here on slide number 3. And the smaller deficit in Q3 actually becomes a small surplus of about 0.1 million barrels a day. And the very small surplus production consumption in Q4 is now a fairly large supply-demand surplus. So what's going on here? Well, part of it is the, you know, it's not just a semantic difference, but the reality is that China has been storing huge amounts of oil in inventory. Saudi Arabia has been parking oil all over the Middle East, all in advance of this Iran sanction deal. So there's a whole lot of supply out there that's not getting counted in production and consumption. If we go on to slide 3, this is, or 4 rather, that's the essence of what's happening. It's just the supply-demand balance that I showed in the previous, blown up so everybody can see it. And what they're doing here, what EIA is doing here, is they're saying, well, gee, guys, you know, we're at a minus 0.2 million barrel a day deficit right now, and the average price of Brent is 68 and change. So what do we think it's going to turn into if we go from a deficit to a surplus? And by my estimation, they're actually being very optimistic in this forecast by saying, you know, if we take a minus 2.2 million a day and turn it into a 0.8 million a day surplus, we actually only go down by a buck. So that's what's going on. And so everybody thinks that oil prices are too low right now. And I say, well, not according to the way the market's willing to pay for it. And so if you feel like it's too low, well, okay. But, you know, basically the market sets the price, and that's what we're dealing with here.
Okay, Art, thanks for that. We'll be back with our first discussion topic, some puzzling developments in natural gas markets, right after this. For our first major discussion topic this week, we're going to examine natural gas markets. As any seasoned natty trader can tell you, the demand for storage effectively guarantees that the front end of the natural gas futures curve will be in steep contango during summer months, when the demand for product is lowest and therefore the demand for storage is highest. And normally, that's a great little factoid to impress people at a cocktail party with, except for one tiny little problem. It's summertime right now, and yet the July-August time spread, that's the NQ spread in trader parlance, has moved into backwardation. Art Berman, let's start with you, since you're so good at impressing people at cocktail parties. What is causing this backwardation in the front end of the natural gas term structure? How often does this happen, and what does it mean for markets? Are there any fundamental drivers that explain this unusual relationship?
Well, you've taken all the cocktail party intrigue out of it already for me, Eric. So I've got nothing left except to say that the answer is pretty simple, and that is we've got way too much natural gas, according to the market in the United States. And so the paradigm has changed. And so what we're looking at here in my slide number 5 is a series of forward curves for natural gas that most of them are in May and June, but I've got one for March just to show the high end. And what we see here is that the red curve is last Friday and the blue one above it is yesterday's. And so as you suggested, normally, you know, we should be in a contango portion of that sine wave, and instead we're in backwardation. So that's not normal. If we go on to slide number 6, I'll back up and give those who aren't all that familiar with natural gas forward curves a little bit of a primer here. And so if we look at the orange forward curve at the bottom of the graph, that's the way natural gas always used to be. That was what we called normal. Normal means that during fill season, we're in contango, basically from May to January or December, and from December to April, we're in backwardation, reflecting seasonal demand. But it's always going up. Well, once the United States really got crazy with producing much more natural gas than we ever did before in 2017, that pattern got inverted. And that's the blue set of forward curves. So instead of everything going up in kind of a general contango, we have 2 years worth of supply going down and then moving up. So basically, the surge in production that the U.S. has experienced has modified the whole term structure of natural gas forward curves. Moving on to slide 7 very quickly, this just shows the surge, including all the other surges that we've seen since 2008. And what's happened here is that since January 17, U.S. production has increased 18.5 BCF a day. I mean, that's just absolutely, it's mind-boggling that that's happened. And so what's resulted is that markets have said, gee, why do we need all this gas storage if we have so much supply at the wellhead? And so what's happened is that people who follow gas markets have noticed that we went into this winter heating season with the lowest working gas in storage in history. And everybody thought, me included, oh my God, you know, we're vulnerable to all kinds of price spikes. And we did have some price spikes, but generally we made it through okay. That's what I call just-in-time natural gas supply. In other words, storage has been downgraded as a key factor. And so moving on to slide 8, back to where we started here, what we're seeing now is that we are now translating the mostly successful experiment in just-in-time winter supply to the summer months, and the market's saying, wow, maybe we can get a cheaper price on natural gas if we play the market such that we're actually in backwardation, which, as you started with, Eric, is a disincentive to store. The market's cheap. The market wants to pay the lowest price possible, and that's what it's doing. This is kind of a big deal for those of us that follow gas markets because it is so anomalous. But that's basically the story with natural gas for now.
Chris Cook, let's continue on this subject of natural gas and maybe look at some of the international implications of the trends that Art's describing.
Yeah, well, thanks for that question. That's a really interesting one. It ties in with the conversation Art and I had a couple of weeks ago. It seems to me that there is a policy here for massive, massive investment in U.S. gas. And I don't think anybody's quite got to the bottom of, you know, where this is coming from, because it doesn't exactly seem to be, on the face of it, profitable investment. And that was a subject of our discussion. So you've got this huge amount of gas, and the first thing that you try and do is put in place pipeline. You stop flaring it, you put in pipelines. Next thing you know, well, okay, let's start building export terminals. So this is where the freedom molecules come from. You've got this massive, massive surplus of gas. But my question is, and I asked the same question about oil, you know, who is buying down this curve? Who is defining this curve. We all know that on the sell side, you know, producers actually want to sell it forward, no problem. That's basically how they're actually going to you know, make sure they're going to lock in some sort of surplus. But who's buying down the curve? Somebody is, and whoever is buying down the curve, in my view, is integral to the funding of this natural gas, which makes, as far as I can see, very little commercial sense at all. And I think, and this again is the conversation we were having, yeah, to some extent, shale oil makes some sense at the higher prices, but with gas at these, you know, like crazy low prices, how on earth is this going to be profitable? So that essentially is where I'm coming from on this. And that's without the depth of expertise that Art has on this subject.
Right. If I can jump in here, I completely agree with Chris. I followed natural gas, shale gas, long before I was considered by anybody, including myself, that much of an expert on oil. And shale gas has been questionably profitable in the United States since prices collapsed after the financial crisis in 2008. And so what's happened here basically is that so much of the U.S. gas supply was tied up in the northeastern part of the country, in the Marcellus and the Utica, and there was really no good way to get that gas out of the Northeast. And so suddenly pipeline companies came along and said, gee, guys, we'd be happy to build you some pipes if you just are willing to make a commitment to underwrite it. And all the producers says, yeah, let's do that. And so they made these somewhat onerous, what we call send or pay commitments, which mean, you know, we commit to give you a certain amount of gas. And if we can't meet that commitment, we have to pay a penalty. Well, so the problem they had was their gas was stranded. They got it unstranded. They produced so much gas into those pipelines that they were actually making less money unstranded than they were stranded. And my question is, where did these guys go to business school anyway? I mean, don't they understand the fundamentals of supply and demand, that your price goes down if you supply too much? So the brilliant answer is, let's send it somewhere else. You know, it's like the U.S. sending its garbage to India or to China. You know, Mikey will take it. Somebody's got to want it. And whether we make any money off of it is sort of another story. But back to Chris's comment about the freedom molecules, for as much as I like to blame Trump for, you know, a lot of the problems we have in the world right now, it was actually Hillary Clinton that got that thing started. She recruited 50 some odd people to work in the State Department to do nothing but send propaganda out to the rest of the world about why they should start buying U.S. shale gas. So she didn't have the audacity to call them freedom molecules, but this goes across U.S. party lines. It's just part of American exceptionalism. We're so great that, you know, everybody wants whatever we have.
Pat Hemsworth, Art and Chris have been discussing fundamental drivers for natural gas markets. You sit on a commercial trading desk watching the actual order flow. So what are you seeing in terms of tying all of this conversation back to actual market price action?
Well, you know, what we're seeing is, the other gentleman described, we're seeing the market in a backwardated structure. And, you know, I just, in preparation for this call, I just went back for a number of different years and checked the July, August to see how that expired. And it's funny, but ever since we really started with our LNG exports, you know, that started to become a little bit steadier. So right now we're in a good backwardation. We came off a little bit today. The market actually was responding to weather, and different parts of the country went through, had a little bit hotter than normal temperatures. And so that popped the market a bit. But today we came off and the spreads came off a tiny bit, but we're still in a solid backwardation. And, You know, I suppose I have a question which I might extend to Art or to Chris, but to what extent, you know, I was trying to catch up a little bit on the volumes of gas that we're exporting now through the LNG markets. And I pose the question, does the fact that we are now exporting more and that we are a net exporter, you know, in other words, we're exporting, like when we look at our imports versus, you know, our internal consumption and exports, that we're exporting more than we're importing. We're now a net exporter, and we have four different facilities that are exporting LNG. And so my question is the market structurally different now, and the ordinary kind of shape of the market and the ordinary stock building that goes on in the spring and, you know, and then begins to shift as we go into very high demand periods, is the structure changing because of the shifting patterns of consumption, or I should say the shifting patterns of trade? And so that's kind of my question. Right now we have, just looking at the order flow, we have pretty heavy participation of funds on the long side. So, you know, they're kind of going with the flow, so to speak, and with, you know, this kind of backwardated market. You know, and we've come off quite a bit, but now beginning to rally. So, and that's also a factor in the spreads. So I suppose asking a question as much as I'm answering. So I kind of throw that out to one of the gentlemen if they have any opinion on that.
Art and Chris, what do you think?
Sure, I've got an opinion on that, Pat, and I think you raise a really important point. This is a question actually that Eric asked me about oil. I can't remember how long ago it was in one of our interviews, Eric, but he asked me, well, does all this export of tight oil now somehow change or modify or invalidate the whole comparative inventory approach I've taken? And I think I surprised him when I said, well, no, it doesn't. And he asked me, well, how's that possible? I mean, it's, you know, it's a big outflow. And the answer is that the inventory doesn't care who's using it. Okay. I mean, it's still looking at how's my storage volume working relative to some 5-year average. And so just to clarify, this month or last month in May, U.S. exports were, net exports were about 4.4 BCF a day. Okay. And I just showed a slide before that said that production was 90 BCF a day and average consumption in 2018 was, you know, maybe 85 or 86. So this volume, this 4 or 5 BCF a day is really not a very huge proportion of U.S. production or consumption. I mean, it's, you know, it's something like 2%. So to date, it's just an escape valve. It's a way to get rid of some surplus gas, albeit, you know, not profitably. So certainly not for now. I mean, it's a good question, Pat, but no, I don't think it materially changes things. If we didn't have this export of natural gas going on, then the price of gas would probably be a dollar or $1.50 because we just have no way to consume it all.
Chris, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting what's been happening, thanks to shale, in terms of there is no global market in LNG per se. Although a lot of people talk about how one could evolve, there is no benchmark, or no global benchmark anyway. But I do think that we are seeing something of a convergence between we used to see really, really high prices in the Far East, which I think we're now seeing a gradual global convergence in the gas market, thanks to more and more, you know, LNG coming into the system. I mean, we're importing LNG into literally just over the hill from where I'm sitting into Grangemouth into petrochemicals. INEOS are up to doing that. So there is a sort of fungibility going on here. I mean, molecules are molecules are molecules. And as I said earlier, there's no flag on these things. You know, CH4 is CH4, wherever you be. So I think this is tending towards the evolution of a new global market in gas. I was instrumental back in the day in the IPE. I was in charge of the process of opening the balancing point contract in the UK. I was the legal designer on that. So I could imagine a global balancing point in natural gas. That would be a very interesting thing to do.
Yeah, and another point I'd like to make here, just so we don't lose perspective, and that is the narrative is that the United States is this, superstar of natural gas. And there's no doubt that the United States produces more natural gas than anybody else. But, let's back off that and talk about who are the real powerhouses of natural gas reserves. And the answer is not the United States. You can look at any source you like, look at BP, look at EIA, look at anybody. And far and away, the superpowers of gas are Russia and Iran. They tower above everybody else, like five or six times the reserves of the United States. Third in the lineup is Turkmenistan. Fourth is Qatar, and the U.S. is kind of a long fifth. So the propaganda is, well, everybody wants U.S. gas. Well, yeah, except people who can get gas that's closer to home if you're in Europe or in Asia. You're a whole lot closer getting it from Iran, Turkmenistan, Qatar, or Russia. And oh, by the way, their gas is conventional. So not only don't they have the transport costs to get it there, they can get it by pipeline, but it's a whole lot cheaper to produce. So the reality is that the U.S. has to push its product as some sort of a freedom or whatever kind of stupid label they have to put on it, because in truth, they can't compete. They can't compete on price against Russia. And if Iran ever gets into the community of nations, it certainly makes sense, for the very least, for Iran, Turkmenistan to send their gas to India and the rest of South Asia. Russia's building pipelines to supply China, Japan, and Korea. So, U.S. is a little bit late to the party, if you ask me.
Art, your words are sacrilege to those who appreciate the role of Enlightenment electrons in moving. What's it called? Freedom gas? No.
Sorry,
molecules
guys.
Of Enlightenment.
it's electrons of Enlightenment that run the pumps that are used to pump the molecules of freedom. Freedom molecules. Okay. I've lost track of it.
We could probably get a song going here that we could play for your bumper music, Eric.
moving right along, folks, let's come to subject number two for this week's episode, which is the action in markets. Now, I notice an eerie similarity to, I think it was 2 weeks ago, maybe it was 3 weeks ago. What had happened was both RBOB gasoline and the crudes were just above the 5 and 8 day moving averages. And traders were a little eerie on the day that we had a big build. The actual inventory build didn't really move the market that much because a lot of traders were waiting to see a daily close below those short-term moving averages. We got it on the day of the inventory, and the actual big move down wasn't till the next day, Thursday. Seems to me like a real deja vu moment here. What I'm looking at on my charts, both RBOB gasoline and WTI crude have been above their short-term moving averages. We thought maybe they were going to tag the 13, didn't quite get there. As we saw the sell-off today on today's inventory news, which obviously was a big build, we're closed below those moving averages. It seems like we didn't take out last week's lows. That's maybe the only bullish sign I see. But as I look at where things are headed, it feels to me like if we do take out those lows, if I look at a TPO chart, I also see there's some low volume nodes right around $50. But if we get below 50, it looks to me like it could be a free fall all the way down to maybe a high 44 handle. Am I the only one crazy enough to think this move could be that far to the downside? Or is it about to reverse here? Let's see what all of our panelists think. Why don't we start with Pat Hemsworth, since she's the one who's actually on the trading desk every day. Pat, what do you think's going on in terms of market price with respect to oil as well as natural gas?
Well, you know, the day that you referred to, the day after the, I think it was almost 3 weeks ago, a Thursday after the bearish build in crude, which sent us down. What happened is that we dropped really sharply. We had from top to bottom, we had a $14 move, which is pretty tremendous with no real bounce. And so what I was looking for was some kind of corrective rally. And, you know, so we're waiting for the Mexican tariff story. You know, that seemed to be one little block in the whole macroeconomic demand side weakness that helped us to accelerate to the downside. Anyway, you know, that was last Sunday night. And, you know, we got the news on Friday that there would be no Mexican tariffs. And actually, I had some people that were sort of interested in what was going to happen with the opening on Sunday night and who, you know, were considering buying. And what happened was we had an opening then to 54.84 basis the July. We went there and we just kind of drifted a little lower. And then, you know, we came in on Monday here and the market just drifted a little lower again. You know, I was very discouraged by that movement. And, you know, I thought perhaps we could get some sort of bounce to maybe 54, 50, 60 and sort of stay over there and then pop to 57. And then we could sell on a counter, like a bear market rally. We never got anywhere near there. And then that's when I thought, this looks so bad. And so then this report really sort of confirmed the negative direction. And no, I don't think you're crazy at all. I think that what we're up for right now, it has no momentum really to the upside. And I think that we're now going to test key support. The recent low was 50.11. So I think we'll probably look to test that. The other thing too that's sort of interesting is that as far as open interest and fund participation, they are shaking off long positions. I mean, that's maybe sort of obvious, except for distillate, the funds are actually getting short. They're net short. Anyway, I'm really not terribly hopeful. I don't know. I think we do have a shot at testing the $50 level soon.
Well, if I want to offset that with a bullish view, I know better than to ask Art Berman. So let me try Chris Cook, although I'm not too optimistic there. Chris, any bullish viewpoint to share here?
No, you won't find me being a bull in this market at all. I take a fairly radical view of where we're at. You know, there seems to be a view that because the market went, you know, it was 5 years between 80 and 120, and since then it's been bouncing up and down from all the way down to 40 or 35, I think, and then bouncing back up and down 45 up to 75, 85. That, you know, people say, oh, $60 is cheap. And I'm saying, well, tell that to the Chinese, you know, tell them that that's cheap. When the price goes from an additional dollar a barrel for them is $10 million a day. And that ain't cheap. And I take the view that the Chinese are making I do not think that the sell side has an absolute God-given right to set the price. We've seen in the past that markets actually move. You have long-term cycles and short-term cycles. We see the short-term cycles in natural gas beautifully on Art's graphs, you know, up and down in the year, you know? And I really think that the Chinese, who are strategic, if they're anything, they're sitting there with, billion barrels of storage capacity, and we don't know how much of that is full. They are a buyer of last resort, which I mean they'll buy from anybody, and they don't give a damn about sanctions, actually. So it's just a matter of how much they can gouge from Iran or anybody else. So they are the cheapest buyers, and that basically means that they're in a position to set gasoline and, you know, export gasoline and undercut anybody else. So I take a view that if the Chinese back off in the market, and we probably won't know if they have, it will quite soon lead to pain. And the fact is they have the inventory capacity. They have oil stored, which enables them to just say, hey, guys, we're not going to buy 2 million barrels a day that we used to for a while, thank you. And, you know, and then what's going to happen in the market? So I think that we need to look very carefully. I think there's a big swing coming to the buy side. I think the idea of a buy side cartel You know, buy side club. China are already talking to India. You know, lots of other countries in the Far East. The only question I would ask is which way would the EU jump? Would they join the club? Because they're structurally short, you know? I don't think the sell side's got a God-given right to $60 oil is what I'm saying, you know, strategically, big picture. So I see it going down, and I see it potentially going down quite quickly.
All righty. Thank you, Chris. Art?
Well, I can't be a bull, but I can be a non-bear. How about that? Is there such a word? So my perspective on this, there's really two things that I'm looking at right now, and I completely agree, you know, with both Pat and Chris. I mean, all those points are very, very well taken and strong. There are two factors that I look at here that argue somewhat differently. Not to anyone's surprise, the first is comparative inventory. And comparative inventory says that at yesterday's prices, WTI and Brent were still undervalued by a couple of bucks, maybe $3 or $4 at least. Okay, so we got a fresh storage report at least on, well, we got a fresh storage report on May from EIA for OECD, and we got a fresh storage report for last week from EIA on WTI. And what I just said is current prices are somewhere between $2, $3, $4 too low based on comparative inventory. Now, markets don't give a damn about comparative inventory when momentum is carrying them one way or another. And I sure get that. The other thing I look at, that was number one. Number two is volatility. And I look pretty carefully at the, you know, the OVX. And the OVX was really, really high on May 31st when things got crazy with price. And it sort of settled down. And as of yesterday and today, I was saying, you know, I think we're at or near a bottom based on volatility. And volatility today has picked up. Latest reading is 43.15, which doesn't mean anything to most people, but it takes it well up into the above average area. So a day or so ago, I was saying, you know, volatility settled down. I don't see that it's going to go a lot lower. Still not super high, but it's high enough that the momentum can drag it. But the fundamentals right now are telling me we're already too low, which doesn't in any way mean that we won't go lower. And we could go a lot lower, but they're going to spring back. Okay. So this is one of those price discovery, sentiment driven excursions that I talk about all the time. And so anybody who wants to bet against the market, if we go to 50 or lower, boy, I'd bet against that in a heartbeat.
Well, I'll come in with a contrary view, Art. As much as I appreciate what you've said, something I've noticed in the last several weeks, what was containing my bearishness a few weeks ago is I looked at the WTI crude tape. And, you know, as much as I can make up an economic story, really, if I look at all of my charts, it's just mirroring exactly what the S&P was doing. And I thought, okay, S&P is selling off because of trade talk tensions. S&P is going to recover when they figure out that it's a bunch of theatrics and there probably will be some kind of trade deal at some point. When the S&P recovers, crude oil is going to recover too. What we're seeing in the last week or so is S&P is recovering very, very briskly. Crude oil is not following suit. So the way I'm looking at this is the S&P and the bond market, treasury yields, are at odds with each other. The treasury market is telling us that there's a recession coming and the situation economically is getting worse, maybe a lot worse. The stock market is telling us nothing's wrong. At the moment, crude oil seems to be siding with the bond market. And I think the question is, does that continue? And if there's something that pulls us out of this, I think it's probably a rumor or an actual confirmed trade deal with China, which I don't think has that much impact on what's really going on in crude oil markets. But from a sentiment standpoint, it could lead to a recovery. If we go the other way and the rest of the market figures out that maybe the bond market has it right and this really is a recession signal and that we're heading into a recession in 2020, I think there's plenty of room to go considerably lower from here into the mid-40s.
And I'm not disputing. I mean, we've been $15 above the yield curve, the comparative inventory yield curve, and $15 below it since August. And so I'm not in any way saying we couldn't go, if I said we're $2 or $3 low now, add 10 to it, and we're at 40. So that's completely within the range or the error bars, the sentiment-driven error bars of the methods that I use. But I don't believe that that's sustainable. I believe the fundamentals will eventually pull it back to somewhere closer to where it should be, WTI at 55 or 60, and, you know, add 7 or 10 for Brent.
Yeah, I mean, just that we had like a $14 plus range in 3 weeks. So I think we can have an extension of the drop, but it won't necessarily stay there. And we're also coming closer to the OPEC meeting. So, and I thought what Art said about volatility was very interesting. Where the market was in terms of volatility 3 weeks ago, when the market dropped, it was about 22%. So we have had quite a crazy move. So does that mean that it will stop here? No, I think we'll test $50 and we'll see what happens. The RSI is, if you look at that as an indicator, it's below 20%. So, yeah, we're oversold, but that does not necessarily mean that it can't continue. But I do think we're going to get a test of $50.
Well, and I think that where we both agree very strongly, Pat, is the next thing to watch is the test of 50 and what happens there. If you see a firm rejection off of 50, it could very well be a bottom that's going to last a while. On the other hand, if we break 50 decisively, that says to me there's plenty of downside possible from there. I think that covers our discussion of price for this episode, but we'll certainly come back and revisit this question next week and see where the market is headed. Listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town and that we intend to become the definitive weekly information source for energy traders, investors, and others interested in energy markets. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes or at macrovoices.com, and you'll gain access to our Thursday night podcast as well, which has a much more general macroeconomics focus. We're also looking for sponsors so that we can keep all of our Macro Voices content free to the listener. To save time here on the podcast, I've prepared a detailed video explaining the opportunity for sponsoring Energy Week and other Macro Voices content. You can find the video at www.macrovoices.com/sponsorinfo. That's all one word, no punctuation, macrovoices.com/sponsorinfo. If your company is interested in sponsoring Macro Voices, Energy Week, or any other content that we produce, please email me at info@macrovoices.com. Before we close, I want to ask each of our panelists what they're going to be watching for in the coming week in energy markets. Pat Hemsworth, let's start with you. What are you looking for in the week ahead?
Well, as usual, I'll be watching the outright price action and to see what happens if we get an extension of this sell-off. But, you know, also the clients are really very focused on all the differentials, and I'm watching the crack spreads for distillate and for RBOB. So I'm watching those all very closely. I'm watching WTI Brent, which Brent August, September, the spot month versus the second month has come off. It traded down to 76 today after a record high of 146 last week. So, you know, that has made WTI relatively stronger to the Brent. So, you know, I'm watching that very closely. And I'm going to be watching for the farmers, see what's happening with the planting. So, yeah, that's what I'll be keeping an eye on.
Chris Cook, what has your attention in the week ahead?
Well, it's what's going on right now in Tehran, actually. The president of Japan is there for the first time in 40 years. Japan get on with the US, they get on with Iran, and there aren't many countries could say that. Some commentators say that he's got no chance of mediating because the two sides are too far apart. I think there are some interesting conversations to be had. I think we reached in a crucial point in terms of the relationship between the US and Iran. You know, there's a lot of noise and a lot of threats on both sides. And, you know, if something does go pear-shaped in the Persian Gulf, well, it's going to make a big, big move in the oil market. So I'm watching that like a hawk. I'm really interested right now. I think we're at a turning point in the relationships affecting Iran.
And Art Berman, what are you watching for in the week ahead?
I'm watching the things that we've discussed in this conversation, and I'm learning to watch additional things as we continue these discussions. And we had an EIA report come out yesterday. We've got OPEC's monthly report coming out tomorrow, and IEA later this week. So I'm going to be watching to see what kinds of divergence we can add to the mix of what EIA's already provided. And that gives me more than enough fertile ground and updating to do to see what I think when the week is over.
Fantastic. Before we let the panel go, I'd like to just ask each of you to tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do. Let's pick it up with you, Art, since we were just talking to you. ArtBerman.com. What can our listeners expect to find there?
You can find just about everything, I think, from my Twitter feed shows up there, which is at AEBerman12, if you want to go directly. You know, I show podcasts like this one, blogs, all kinds of information. So ArtBerman.com or at AEBerman12 on Twitter.
Chris Cook, where can our listeners follow your work?
Best place is Twitter, where I'm to be found on as CJENSCOOK. C Jens Cook is where I'm to be found. And I commend to you my latest articles on Molecules of Freedom. And the other one is A Low Carbon Enlightenment. Both of them, as it happens, just been published in the Tehran Times, guys. I'm big in Iran. There we go.
You know, Chris, my subscription to the Tehran Times just ran out last week, and so I'm going to miss that one. Pat, maybe I can borrow your copy, but meanwhile, why don't you tell our listeners?
Anytime.
Pat, please tell our listeners where they can follow your work.
Well, I'm on Twitter. I'm pretty active on Twitter, so it's at P. Hemsworth. And I publish different snippets during the day of things that I see that are going on in the market with charts, etc. And also, if your listeners would like to get a copy of my commentary, they could send me an email at phemsworth@paragonglobalmarkets.com. And I just ask a little snippet if you could tell me what your interest specifically in energy is, and I'll be happy to send that to you. I send it out to clients every morning, and it's a kind of a recap of market action with a lot of charts and explanation to the chart, you know, on chart action. So I'd be happy to send that.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Pat. Macro Voices Energy Week is released every Wednesday evening. Next week's panel includes Anas Alhaji, Pat Hemsworth, and Joe McMonagle. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. See you next week, everybody.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.